And so you see, the solar storms will die down. And so, it's quiet time for all you satellites out there. Good night.
Phil? Phil!
What do you want?
It's February 1st, Phil. You know what that means for tomorrow.
Oh, no. No. Not this year.
Come on. It's a cute story. The Jodcast comes out. If it's self-referential in its intro, we'll get 40 more months of astronomy podcasting.
No way. No way. Okay, what do you give me?
Have Rita, new producer. Hey, Rita!
Yes?
Can you cover the Muxitani Chester Jodcast Festival with Phil here?
Sure thing.
Great! Have him back by 5 for the evening bulletin.
Okay, let's get this over with. Roll camera. Twice a month, the eyes of the world turn to this little city in the northwest, to the world's most famous astronomy podcaster, Muxitani Chester Phil. And here's the moment you've all been waiting for. Let's see what the Jodcast has to say.
The Jodcast, truly a team creation. With Megan Argo, David Alt, Jen Gupta, Dave Jones, and Ian Morrison. The Jodcast, February 2010 edition. Hello and welcome to this edition of the Jodcast. And today you've got me and Jen. Hello, Jen.
Hey, Dave. Hey, everyone.
In this edition of the Jodcast, we're bringing you a set of interviews with the astronomers of the Isaac Newton Group of Telescopes in La Palma. And we'll be hearing what you can see in the night sky in February. But first, before all of that, here's the news with Megan Argo.
In the news this month, Chandra tells tales of extragalactic star formation, coronal loops imaged around another star, and the coolest brown dwarf yet. Star formation is usually thought of as occurring mainly in the spiral arms of galaxies. In close encounters or collisions between galaxies, the orbits of these stars around the galactic disk can be disrupted, resulting in some stars being thrown out into intergalactic space. But new results from the Chandra X-ray Observatory suggest that, at least in some cases, stars can form outside the normal boundaries of galactic disks. A team, led by Ming Sun at the University of Virginia, used the orbiting Chandra telescope to observe galaxies in a nearby rich cluster, known as Abel 3627. What they found were several enormous tails of X-ray emission, trailing behind galaxies located in the cluster. Tails like these are made up of X-ray-emitting gas, which is stripped from a galaxy as it moves through the cluster. One of these galaxies, ESO-137-001, was already known to have one X-ray tail, which extends approximately 260,000 light-years from the galaxy itself. But in these observations, the team found a second tail, apparently associated with the same galaxy. This new tail is of a similar length to the first, but is both fainter and narrower. Both the widths and temperatures of the tails remain surprisingly constant over their entire lengths, and these properties present challenges to current models and simulations of such systems. A similar tail of about half the length was also detected behind ESO-137-002, another similar galaxy in the same cluster. Together with observations using telescopes operating in other parts of the electromagnetic spectrum, the research also shows the first unambiguous evidence of star formation in the material stripped from a galaxy. Rather than forming in the galactic disk as normal, these stars are forming in the gas stripped from the disk as the galaxy moves through the tenuous gas in the cluster. X-ray tails are rare, and double tails are extremely rare, so one question is, why should there be two bright X-ray tails visible in the same cluster? In their paper, published in the Astrophysical Journal, the researchers suggest that, aside from coincidence, the high ambient pressure in this particular cluster could play a role, making the X-ray tails denser and more luminous. If this is the case, the high-pressure environment would also be helping the process of extragalactic star formation. Most of our knowledge of the processes and morphology of the stellar corona come from observing our nearest star, the Sun. Coronal loops are associated with sunspot groups, which affect the streams of charged particles leaving the Sun as the solar wind, so an understanding of the processes in these loops has implications for space weather predictions, which can impact on satellite operations and the safety of astronauts. Studying the same processes in other stars is difficult due to the distances involved and the high resolution required to see any detail. Some of the highest resolution observations possible in astronomy are made using arrays of radio telescopes linked together in a process known as very long baseline interferometry. The more widely separated the telescopes in the array, the higher the resolution of the final images. Using this technique, a team led by William Peterson, a graduate student at the University of Iowa, have detected a large coronal loop on another star. Using a very sensitive array of radio telescopes, which included the 10 antennas of the Very Long Baseline Array in the US, the 100-meter Greenbank Telescope in West Virginia, the Very Large Array in New Mexico, and the 100-meter Effelsberg Telescope in Germany, the astronomers imaged the variable star Algol in Perseus. Algol is an eclipsing binary system, consisting of a large main-sequence B-class star and a cooler K-class subgiant in orbit around each other. The two stars are very close, just 6% of the distance between the Earth and our own Sun, and orbit each other every 2.86 days. The results show a gigantic coronal loop stretching out from the surface of Algol B, the K-class subgiant star, towards its companion, Algol A, with the two ends of the loop located at the magnetic poles of the subgiant star. Throughout the orbit, this loop continues to point towards Algol A. The researchers say that Algol B's coronal loop is similar to those seen on the Sun, but is much larger, and the magnetic field at Algol is about 1,000 times more powerful. The size of the coronal loop is larger than predicted by stellar models, and the suggestion is that this is probably due to the tidal effects of the companion star distorting the loop and stretching it. The results, the first time a coronal loop has been imaged on another star, were published in the journal Nature on January the 14th. An international team, led by astronomers at the University of Hertfordshire, have discovered what may be the coolest substellar body ever found outside our own solar system. Using the United Kingdom Infrared Telescope, or UKIRT, in Hawaii, the astronomers have discovered a type of object known as a brown dwarf, smaller than other stars, but larger than gas giant planets such as Jupiter. The object, known as SDSS-1416+13b, is only visible in infrared light, and is in a wide orbit around a somewhat brighter and warmer brown dwarf known as SDSS-1416+13a. This discovery is the fourth time in 3 years that UKIRT has made a record-breaking discovery of the coolest known brown dwarf, with an estimated temperature not far above 200 degrees Celsius, said the University of Hertfordshire's Dr. Philip Lucas. The light detected from the star is rather unusual. It appears far bluer, at near-infrared wavelengths, than any other brown dwarf detected so far. A near-infrared spectrum, taken with the Japanese Subaru telescope in Hawaii, showed that it belongs to a class of objects known as T-dwarfs, and that it has a lot of methane in its atmosphere, but with peculiar features, including a big gap at certain wavelengths. Using the Spitzer Space Telescope to measure its colour at mid-infrared wavelengths, the researchers found that it is also the reddest known brown dwarf at these wavelengths by some margin. A comparison with theoretical models of brown dwarf atmospheres results in a temperature estimate of just 500 Kelvin, or 227 degrees Celsius. In comparison, our own Sun has a surface temperature of approximately 6,000 Kelvin. Both stars are also lacking in heavy elements, an indication that they may be very old, which fits in with the low temperature of the fainter star. Fainter stars use up their fuel much slower and can last for many billions of years. The research has been accepted for publication in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society. And finally, the HiRISE instrument on board the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter has been taking spectacular images since the probe entered orbit around the planet in 2006. One particular image, posted to Astronomy Picture of the Day on January the 19th, caused something of a stir. The image shows a series of pinkish-coloured sand dunes covered with a light frost located near the North Pole of Mars, taken on the 7th of April 2008 during the Martian spring. As the sun started to melt the carbon dioxide ice, the sand started to shift, cascading down the dunes in dark streaks which look uncannily like trees in the image taken by the HiRISE instrument on board the orbiter. The image covers an area of roughly 1 square kilometre and resolves objects as small as 25 centimetres. The colour variations in the ice around the streaks are thought to be caused by dust kicked up as the material shifts and settles on the surface.
Thanks for that, Megan. And now on to our interviews. Now, while Dave Jones was in La Palma in January, he caught up with a few of the astronomers of the Isaac Newton Group of Telescopes. And here are those interviews.
Hello, I'm here to speak to Pablo Rodriguez of the Isaac Newton Group in La Palma. Hello, Pablo.
Hello.
So what would you like to speak to us about today?
I'm going to speak about my research field. It's basically compact binaries. We will, be deeper into that in the interview.
Okay, so what do you mean when you say a compact binary?
Well, it's not an obvious thing if you think only on our sun, at least a single star. But in our galaxy and in other galaxies, stars are not born alone. Actually, they are born forming part of double systems, triple systems. Gravitation is very powerful. So I'm focusing now on binary stars. A binary star is actually a system of two stars orbiting each other, or orbiting a common center of what we call the center of mass. And by compact, I mean one of the stars in the system, in the binary system, is a compact star. It's a very, very dense star, that means very heavy, very massive, and very small. So density is very high. And we know that we can have three types of compact star. By increasing density, white dwarf, neutron stars, and black holes. All of them are the result of the final stages of a life, of the life of stars. I'm centered on binary stars, compact binaries, with white dwarfs as primary or more massive stars.
So that would be the least extreme of the three
yes,
types?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, yeah. So what makes these compact binaries with white dwarfs so interesting?
There is something like 50% of the binary systems in our galaxy, in other galaxies, will interact. What kind of interaction? Some of them are so close to each other. The two stars of the binary are so close that gravity, the gravity pull, can strip some mass from one of the components. So in the case of compact binaries with the white dwarf as a primary component, the gravitational pull of the white dwarf can take some mass off the companion star. And that mass accretes on the white dwarf. That's a process called accretion. And it's so interesting because accretion is the process in the universe that yields the most energy per unit mass, per gram of mass. So that's a very interesting and very powerful energy production process.
Okay, so what techniques do you use to study these close compact binaries?
Well, as all the problems or in astrophysics or astronomy, the main thing is that these guys are very, very far away. Cataclysmic variables, that is what we call the binaries with a white dwarf and a normal, a star like our sun, of a bit less massive. As I said, they are far away and they're very close. Both components are very close to each other. Even the biggest telescopes, we cannot resolve both the stars. Mm-hmm. So when we point the telescope to one of those systems, binary systems, we only see a point of light. And we have to figure out what's going on there with only a point of light. So basically, we search for variability. So that's how the light from the whole system varies. Because there are some processes inside that we believe actually they produce non-variability. And most of the time rapid variability, like the rotation, fast rotation of the white dwarf, that can be of the order of 10 minutes or 15 minutes.
So that's variability in brightness?
Yes. And there is also variability related to the orbit, motion of the stars, that can give you the orbital period of the system. And that's a main number, before going deeper into the system. And there is also spectroscopy. We can divide the light coming from the system in all the colors, like, you know, like a rainbow. And studying the different emission lines or absorption lines in the system, we can figure out what, you know, what's the composition of the stars, or what are the velocities, you know, the orbital velocities involved, the orbital periods as well, and get deeper on the accretion process itself, the presence of magnetic fields in the white dwarf, because, you know, we know that many of them are magnetic, and so on.
So when you say compact binaries, how compact are we talking? How close together are these things? What sort of periods, orbital periods, do these things have?
They're really, really close. So in cataclysmic variables, we find from, you know, the order of 1 day, most of them are between 3 to 5 hours. So, you know, on a flight from the Canaries to the UK, one of these guys make a whole orbit, down to 70, 80 minutes. So that's fast. Mm-hmm. If you put one cataclysmic variable, you know, after each other from the Earth to the Sun, you can accommodate there 1,000 or more. So that can give an idea of how compact. I mean, but compact, I mean the accreting star. Mm-hmm. But they are also compact in terms of
being close together.
Size. Yeah.
Okay, so in these systems, they're so close together that one star is tearing matter away from the other. Is that a continual process, or do you see that varying with time?
That's a good question. Actually, not. Most of the time, they are active. I mean, you know, gravitation is so powerful that, you know, the white dwarf is stripping the companion continuously. But we know that there's some states, I mean, at some point, accretion can stop, or at least be at the level, at a very, very low level. That's what we call low states. They are very, very interesting, and, you know, a CV in the low state can give a lot of information. Why? Because the way matter goes from the companion star to the white dwarf is not, I mean, a straight way. You know, keep in mind that these guys are orbiting, so you have some inertia, or, you know, what we call angular momentum. And the matter goes from the companion to the white dwarf through an accretion disk. So there is a disk of material orbiting the white dwarf, right? And the disk is being continuously fed by the companion or donor star. And the brightness of that disk, because accretion is so powerful, is very, very, very high. So even with spectra, with spectroscopy, we cannot discern, you know, we cannot see the spectra of both stars separately, because the brightness of the accretion disk veils everything. But luckily enough, during these low states, that where the, you know, the brightness of the whole system can drop by 100, you know, or 100 or 1,000, then the accretion disk goes away, because the material is not shed to the white dwarf anymore, or the accretion disk. So we are pioneering these observations of very of low states, but the problem is that in the low states, these guys are very faint. So you need very big telescopes to study both stars. And we have managed to do that here at the ING and at the Astrophysics Institute in Tenerife, using you know, the biggest telescopes in the world, like the Gemini, the very large telescope in Chile, and probably the Gran Telescopio Canarias, the 10.4-meter telescope in La Palma.
So how long do these low accretion states last? Is it a very short time, so you have to be very quick with your observations, or can they last?
We have seen from 1 month to a couple of years. But I think most important, okay, the duration is important, I think most important is the time between low states. Because our observations are beginning to show that the low states are probably linked to stellar activity in the secondary star, in the donor star, like the stellar activity we see in the Sun, with, you know, magnetic field, prominences, spots. So that's very interesting, because we can probe magnetic activity and magnetic cycles. So studying that kind of cycles in other, you know, stars are more extreme stars, because the rotation of the donor star in cataclysmic variables is much faster than the rotation of the Sun, you know, around its axis. So we can have extreme manifestations of that kind of, you know, spots or prominences and, you know, stellar winds and everything. So we are now understanding that that can be related, you know, low states can be related to star cycles, you know, magnetic cycles in the star. So that's very, very, very interesting, but very difficult to observe because the need of large telescopes.
So you work here at the Isaac Newton Group on La Palma. In fact, you're the INT manager, the manager of the 2.5 meter telescope here.
That's right.
Have you used the telescopes of the ING to do these observations? Can they play an important role in these observations?
Yes, actually, they are pretty important. We do the, let's say, the faint stuff with larger telescopes, like the VLT in Chile, Gemini North in Hawaii. But you need to know when one of these cataclysmic variables fall in another state. And for that, we use brightness monitoring from telescopes, you know, amateur telescopes from, you know, 20 centimeter, 15 centimeter. So there is a group of amateurs in mainland Spain that are monitoring a number of 50 of these systems. So they send an alarm when one of the systems is, you know, falling down, the brightness of one of the systems falls down. So from that, we have to check if that's true with, you know, a bigger telescope, and then take one spectrum to see if we can see both, you know, the spectra of both the stars, the white dwarf and the donor star. If we see that, and we see that with the WHT, William Herschel Telescope on La Palma, or the Isaac Newton Telescope, we trigger our guaranteed programs that called Target of Opportunity program at VLT in Chile, if, you know, the star is observable from Chile, or the Gemini North. So it's a, you know, chain of information from 15 centimeter telescope to 8 point something meter telescope. And actually this January, on the 4th, we took we monitored the brightness of one of the guys in the lowest state called in the constellation Auriga, and we got very, very interesting results and new results. So that can give you an idea of, you know, the utility of any kind of telescope, I mean optical telescope. And if the thing, you know, goes, I mean, the low state lasts a lot, you know, longer, so we can have access or send proposals to X-ray telescopes, or we are thinking about involving the Hubble Space Telescope because it's almost going back to operation again.
So you mentioned X-ray telescopes.
Yeah.
What extra information do you get by looking at a cataclysmic variable in the X-ray rather than in the optical? What extra information do you get?
That has to do with magnetic fields in the white dwarf. When the material comes from the donor star, it cannot only be transferred to the white dwarf surface through an accretion disk. If the magnetic field of the white dwarf is strong enough, the magnetic pressure doesn't allow a disk to be created. So the material goes straight, you know, connects to the magnetic field lines. Mm-hmm. So we can think about aurorae in the Earth, where, you know, material from the Sun connects to the...
Flows along
the lines of the Earth magnetic field, and then you see all that kind of light, very beautiful aurora. That is happening in the in that kind of CV, but in a high, very very, how can I say that?
Strong magnetic field.
Yeah, there's stronger magnetic field and very huge kind of aurora. And the material, okay, in summary, material from the donor star connects to the magnetic field lines and falls supersonically to the magnetic poles of the white dwarf. Imagine material falling down and then breaking completely on the surface of the white dwarf.
As it crashes into the
surface. Crashes into the surface. So that creates a temperature that is really, really high. And the all that material cools down by the emission of X-rays because of the high temperature. So observing cataclysmic variables and other compact binaries with, for example, neutron stars can give you information of the cooling mechanisms there, the spin period of the compact star, like white dwarf or neutron star. And nobody has never pointed an X-ray telescope, as far as I know, when the CV, when the cataclysmic variable is in the low state. So there is no accretion. But we're now seeing that maybe there are accretion blobs, I mean intermittent accretion. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's worth pointing one of those guys.
So by intermittent accretion, you mean instead of a steady stream?
Yeah. Yeah, it's like the donor star and the whole system, because of the sort of like cycle, it's trying to, I like saying, the system is fighting for accretion. So it's trying to get to the normal state, that is the accretion state. So we pointed the XTE satellite to one of the cataclysmic variables in the low state, but we couldn't see much because accretion wasn't on at that time. So, okay, next time maybe we are lucky.
So as the INT manager, would you be able to tell us a little bit more about how the INT is run, how the INT works, and how visiting astronomers get time on the INT?
Sure. The telescopes of the ING run the Isaac Newton group of telescope, but there are three countries involved in the operation and in the funding of the telescopes, namely the UK, Spain, and the Netherlands. So every 6 months there is an announcement of opportunity, so researchers from the three communities, the three countries, can send proposals. So basically, they think of an interesting project, and that is written down into words, where they explain why that project is interesting, how they are going to do it, in which telescope, and with the instrument, CCDs or spectrographs or polarimeters, everything. And that goes to through a peer review process. I mean, there are panels in Spain, in the UK, and in the Netherlands of senior astronomers that, evaluate those proposals. The ones that get time, so are transferred to us, and then we do scheduling of the proposal in both telescopes. And then visiting astronomers, astronomers can visit our telescopes and carry out the observations themselves. But most of the time, astronomers are new to our telescopes and our instruments. So we have to have what we call support astronomers who introduce the telescopes and all the systems to the visiting astronomers so they can be comfortable observing. If they have a week of observations, we do a very, very detailed introduction to the telescope during the first night. And then they can go solo the rest of the observing run. And at the INT, we have a program of student support astronomers. So we have four students, and they take care of the introductions and everything. And they also learn how to operate a telescope, the different kind of instrumentation we can we can find on telescope spectrographs, direct imaging, polarimetry, adaptive optics, everything. Because the super astronomers, also are exposed to the instrumentation of our biggest telescope, the William Herschel telescope of 4.2 meters. It's a very convenient and interesting program because we give a service to the astronomical community, and the students get experience while interacting with senior astronomers that who come to the telescope to perform the observation. So it's I much like that kind of program, and I hope to get the funding and green light to carry on with that in the future.
Do these student support astronomers come from La Palma, or were they already working here before they became student support astronomers?
Actually, they come from any country. The call for proposals for students is widely worldwide open. So there is an international call, and actually currently we have actually four of them from the UK, but we have had Spanish, Greek students, you only want to learn, be keen to learn a lot, spend some nights at the mountain, and be happy, and that's it.
You said some nights at the mountain. Presumably they don't spend all of their time on the mountain.
No. Most of the time they spend at sea level, where they do, support astronomer duties, tasks like, revising manuals, the telescope. And they are also involved in a research program with senior astronomers at the ING. So actually, I'm supervising the work of two of them this year. And one of them is working with me on cataclysmic variables in the low state. So, apart from their PhD thesis being supervised by, another astronomer in the UK or the Netherlands or in Spain, they learn how to operate telescopes, they master all the techniques of the observing techniques. And in addition, on top of that, they can be involved in a research program with one of the local astronomers of the ING, so this is very, very attractive.
Mm-hmm. That sounds excellent, and I very much enjoyed my year when I did that here.
Yeah, you were one of them.
So I think all that's left to say is thank you very much for speaking to us, and the very best of luck with everything at the ING and with your work on cataclysmic variables.
Okay, thank you very much to you. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, so I'm here for the Jodcast with Dr. Miguel Santander García from the Isaac Newton Group in La Palma. Hello.
Hi.
And we're going to talk to you a little bit about your research. So can you tell us first what kind of research you work in?
I'm mainly working on planetary nebulae.
Okay, so what's a planetary nebula?
Well, to answer that, first of all, we have to clarify something just in case anyone is wondering. A planetary nebula has absolutely nothing to do with planets.
Okay.
The name comes from the fact that when Herschel first observed these objects back in the 18th century, they appeared like round, fuzzy nebula, resembling planets.
Uh-huh.
So he called them planetary nebula. But nowadays we know that they have nothing to do with planets at all. But the name still has some inertia, and we still use it. Now, a planetary nebula is the latest stage of life of a low mass or intermediate mass star, up to 8 times the mass of the Sun.
Okay.
Beyond that, the stars explode as supernovae. But low and intermediate mass stars end their lives by slowly ejecting their envelopes until the only thing that remains at their cores is a hot, inert, white dwarf.
So what do you mean by envelope?
By envelope, I mean the external shells of the star. A star has a core and an envelope, which might vary in depth.
So what's the difference between the core and the envelope? What separates the core of a star from the envelope?
Well, a star is basically a factory in which elements are combined, nuclear fusion, into heavier elements.
Mm-hmm.
And then the heavier elements are denser, weight more, and they then slowly go inwards to the heavier core of the star.
Okay, so the core is made up of heavier elements,
mm-hmm,
while the outer envelope
is made
up of lighter elements.
Mm-hmm, like hydrogen mainly, some helium.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then at the end of its life, the star slowly blows off that envelope, mainly hydrogen and helium and some lighter elements. And then when all we have at the core is the heaviest elements, the temperature on the surface of the of that core, which we call white dwarf, is enough to light up, to ionize the whole envelope, so we can see it in the sky.
And that's a planetary nebula.
And that's a planetary nebula.
What do you work on inside planetary nebulae? What's the main problem or the main question that you're trying to answer?
Well, the main question in planetary nebula is that when we look at planetary nebula, and we know like 3,000 planetary nebulae in our galaxy, many of them are round, but also many of them have different shapes. Some of them are ellipsoidal, and some of them show large degree of collimation in the outflows, which are expanding into space, and some of them are very extremely bipolar, like some butterfly-like. And the main question is to know, to understand how a star, which is mainly a sphere of material, it's mainly round or almost round, when it blows off its envelope, it ends up with a completely different shape than a round nebula. Now, some hypotheses for that involve magnetic fields of the star guiding the material as it flows out. Another very good hypothesis that is currently being researched is that instead of one star at the core, we have two stars. We have a binary system, a closed binary system, which is interacting. So the material tends to be ejected preferentially along the polar axis of the orbit, of the orbital plane of the binary system.
Okay, so if the binary orbits in a plane, like on a piece of paper, the two stars are both on a piece of paper, the nebula expands away from the piece of paper, perpendicular to the piece of paper, at 90 degrees to the piece of paper. So why, if you have a binary system, why would that mean that the matter is able to move away from the plane of the binary, but not in the plane of the binary? What causes that?
Well, if the system, the binary system, is a closed binary, then both stars are interacting. And that means, basically, that one of the stars is donating material to the other star, which gets into onto its surface or into some disk around it. But if the stars are very close, it might happen that the star which is receiving the material has not enough time to process it. So it's getting material from the other star too quickly, so then it cannot process it, and then the material starts to accumulate, and we end up with both stars inside an envelope of gas. And then if we add the interactions that we have because of the stars going into an orbit, then we'll end up with some sort of belt, of donut, around the orbit. And then later on, when the material for the nebula is ejected, it will have no problem to move out of the orbital plane where the donut is, and it will have some problems going into the denser donut that it's around, the belt.
Sure. So it's basically as though it was an expanding sphere, like we would expect, but this donut acts like a waist around this expanding sphere and allows it to move much freer in the polar directions away from perpendicular to the plane of the binary, but slows it down and traps it in the plane of the binary.
That's it.
So now we have this hypothesis to test. Mm-hmm. Okay. How can you test this binary hypothesis?
Next step is finding the binaries, because right now we haven't found many of them. In fact, we only know just that a bunch of systems are in fact binaries, because these objects, planetary nebula and their central stars, are so far away that we can't tell one star. If there are two stars there, close binary, we can't spatially solve the system, so we can't tell one star apart from the other. So we need to invent and develop techniques to observe the core and tell that there are in fact two stars there. What we are doing is to find new binaries to test this hypothesis, to see if most bipolar nebulae come from a close binary system. Mm-hmm. So now we are trying to find new binaries by one technique, which is called photometric monitoring.
So what does photometric monitoring mean?
It means that as the stars go in their orbits, if there's a binary system, if there's a single star, then the brightness will be more or less the same every time. So we will not notice any variation in brightness. But if there are two stars, and imagine the orbital plane is in the line of sight, then one star might eclipse the other as they go round. And then in that moment, we will see a variation in brightness.
Because one star is blocking the light.
Yes, because one star is brighter than the other. So when the brighter star goes before the dimmer star, then we will see some decrease in brightness.
Okay, so to do that, you have to take lots of images of a star, and then check how bright the star is on each image. Mm.
If we see some variation, time variation of the brightness, that might tell us that the system is binary. It's not necessary that it's the orbital plane is in the line of sight, but it could also be some tilting. So the variations can be due to the reflection of the light of one star onto the surface of the other star. We can also tell the difference.
So as well as finding new binaries at the center of planetary nebulae, what else can be done and is being done to investigate the effect of a binary star on the formation of a planetary nebula?
Mm-hmm. That's important, because it's not only a matter of finding binary stars inside planetary nebulae, because what we want to test is that the binary system is the responsible for the shaping, for the bipolar shaping of this nebulae. So it could be just that it's purely coincidental that the star is a binary star, in fact. But if the theory, according to the theory, the binary star ejects the nebula preferentially away from the orbital plane. So the waist of the nebula should be in the same plane, the equator of the nebula should be in the same plane as the orbital plane.
Okay.
Then, when we find a binary through this photometric monitoring, then there are another number of methods, instrumental methods, to derive the parameters of its orbit. And that means that we can know the inclination of the orbital plane, among other things. And then if we know the inclination, means that we can know how that orbit is oriented in the plane of the sky. By looking at the nebula, looking at the image of an image of the nebula, and combining it with spectra of the nebula, we can also develop a three-dimensional model of the structure and velocity pattern of the nebula, which tell us about the age and other other parameters, velocities and such, as well as the orientation of the nebula in the plane of the sky. So what we are testing is, when we find a new binary, we develop a model for that nebula, and we test if the orientation of the nebula is the same as the orientation of the orbital plane. If they are the same, they are similar, then that tells us that the binary system is probably responsible for the shaping of the nebula.
So how close do the binary stars at the center of the nebula need to be to have an effect?
Well, we're not completely sure about how far away they can be. How close there are binaries who orbit has a period of just a couple of hours. So every 2 hours there's one orbit, and that might probably be it, more than enough to shape the nebula. But on the other hand, there are systems of stars which are much further away, with periods of several hundred years, which are still interacting. They are called symbiotic binaries, and which also produce, some of them produce nebulae which are very similar to the planetary nebulae. And we think that binary interaction might probably play a role in the shaping of this nebula. So we are not completely sure of what's the range needed, the distance range or the period range needed for a nebula to be shaped. We are now starting to find new binaries, so maybe it's a little bit early for being sure about that.
You also mentioned that there are very few known binaries. Just to get an idea, as you said earlier, there are about 3,000 known planetary nebulae in the galaxy. How many of those, vaguely, do we know that are that contain a binary star?
Well, no more than a few tens of systems.
So that's a very, very small fraction.
Yeah, it might look disappointing, but in fact, it's hard to find them out. But well, recently we were involved in a campaign, observational campaign, the Mercator Telescope here in La Palma, to find the new binaries in planetary nebulae, and we were quite successful. Out of 20 objects, we clearly, without any doubt, found out that at least 10 are close binary stars.
And close binaries means very close binaries.
Yes,
because you said
really close binaries.
Binaries with periods of hundreds of years, which would be completely undetectable
to us,
can have an effect. So the binaries that you detected at the Mercator were very close binaries.
In fact, one of the problems for us not detecting more binaries might be that their instrumentation only allows us to detect close binaries, because the further away they are, the slower their changes in brightness and their changes in velocity around the orbits are, so the more difficult to detect. So what we are finding, when I mean close binaries, I mean periods from a couple of hours to one to few days.
Yes.
More than that, it's very, very difficult to find.
Okay, so thank you very much, Miguel, and the best of luck with your work here at the ING.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for that, Dave. And now on to all of the bits of news that weren't in the news. Jen, what have you got for us?
Well, first up, I've got quite an interesting news story about solar power in space.
Mm-hmm.
So EADS Astrium are Europe's biggest space company, and they're looking for people to work with them to fly a demonstration solar power mission in orbit. So this is the idea that you take your solar panels into space, you don't have all the atmosphere there to take away anything from the sun's power, and then somehow, I think by infrared, you transmit this power back to Earth.
Ah, so when it says they're looking for people to do it, this is not members of the public then?
Oh, no. They're looking for people to work with them to develop this technology.
Ah, so it'll be going up on rockets, planes?
I assume it's going to be a satellite like orbiting the Earth, so it'll be launched by rocket, I assume.
Okie doke.
But it's something that's been talked about for a very long time, but I think they're finally getting to the stage where they can seriously sit down and plan it out.
Something else that's been around for a long time that we've talked about is Stellarium. which is a wonderful piece of kit for looking at the night sky and discovering objects in space. And Universe Today has put together a guide of some of those objects. So if you've ever clicked on some of the stars in Stellarium and found that they're actually Messier objects, then they have put together this guide, and we'll put the link in the show notes where you can find out a lot more about each one of these. You can find out where it is, its history, and why it's included in the catalogue and everything like that. So that's a very useful thing from Universe Today. Something else that we've been using for quite a while is Twitter. A lot of you are followers of us on Twitter, and the International Space Station now has internet access. So
limited internet access.
Limited internet access, yes. But there, we have now had the first tweet from space, which I think is very, very exciting.
Yeah, so, I mean, the NASA astronauts have had Twitter for quite a while. But what happened before was that the astronauts on the International Space Station sent the tweets down to Houston, I think, and then someone there actually posted them onto the Twitter accounts. They never had the direct access to Twitter before up there.
But now it sounds as if they're VNCing down to the ground and then...
Something like that.
Yeah, I doubt the web has actually got all the way up to the space station.
It'd be a very strong router to get the wireless signal, wouldn't it?
Well, talking of stations up in space, Spirit is now a stationary station. NASA has decided that because it's been... They've been trying to move it since...
They've been trying to move it for quite a while, and what's happened now is that they're moving into the Martian winter. So because Spirit's powered by solar panels, it's not going to be able to get as much power. So I think it's kind of, now's the time to give up, make preparations so that it can survive the Martian winter and still be taking data.
Okay, that's a very good idea.
I mean, it is sad that it's not going to be roving around anymore, but it's stuck in, as we said before, it's stuck in a very interesting place.
Is it possible that they might be able to move it come the Martian summer?
I don't think so. I think at least two wheels have given up now, so it's looking unlikely.
But at least it can still collect data for us.
Yes, so it's definitely not the death of Spirit.
That's good. So Spirit now stuck on Mars in a very interesting place. And Mars is currently one of the most interesting things you can see in the night sky. I've been presenting in the planetarium for the last few weeks, so I know I've been seeing it. And tell us more about what to see in the night sky during February. Here's Ian Morrison.
Well, the night sky for February 2010. Well, as night falls, the constellations of Pegasus and Andromeda are setting towards the west. High in the south, you'll see the wonderful constellation of Orion. The three stars of its belt are great pointers. Down to the left, you have the very bright star Sirius, in Canis Major. Up to the right, you point towards the constellation of Taurus the Bull, with the Hyades and Pleiades clusters. High overhead, above Orion, is the constellation of Auriga, with the bright star Capella. The Milky Way runs through that. There's some very nice open clusters you can see with binoculars or a small telescope. Up to the left of Orion are the twins, Gemini, a nice cluster down towards the upper twins' feet. Then coming over towards the eastern sky, you've got Procyon in Canis Minor, and then a very faint area, which is the constellation of Cancer, but in there at the moment is in fact the planet Mars. And then rising, as the evening goes on, towards the east, is the constellation of Leo. Well, what about the planets this month? Not a bad month, in fact. Jupiter is now beginning to set very soon after sunset. You can still see it in the southwest as darkness falls at a magnitude of about -2. The angular size is still about 33 or so arc seconds. So if the conditions are good, a telescope will show you detail. But of course, it's very low above the horizon, not too easy to see. We'll come back to Jupiter in a highlight later on. Now, in contrast, as Jupiter is sort of going out of our view, Saturn is becoming better. It rises by about 9 p.m. in the middle of the month, and it goes due south about 2:30. So you can see it late in the evening. The angular size of the disk is 19 arc seconds. That stays pretty constant. The rings are actually about 5 degrees in tilt angle, so they're still pretty thin, and perhaps surprisingly, they are actually getting narrower again. And by the end of the month, they'll be about 4 degrees. It's not until the end of March that they begin to open out. That's something to look out for. But of course, as a result, Saturn is not as bright as it often is. Now, Venus has been behind the Sun. It was at superior conjunction. That means it's precisely behind the Sun on January 11th. It's now beginning to climb up into the evening sky. And we'll come back to that when we talk about a conjunction of Venus and Jupiter. Mercury had a morning apparition last month, and it's now moving back towards the Sun. But you might just have a chance of seeing it, particularly on the morning of the 12th, when it is just to the lower right of a very thin crescent moon, just a few degrees above the horizon. You'll need to have a very good eastern horizon or southeastern horizon to see it, though. And of course, Mars has been at its best last month, and still this month it's very good. Opposition was towards the end of January. It's well up in the south by about 10 o'clock in the evening. And it's now, in fact, moving westwards through Cancer. And that continues until March the 8th, when it then, in fact, turns round and comes back through Cancer and into Leo. That'll be the end of its so-called retrograde motion. Bit more about Mars later on. So what about the highlights of the month? Well, as I briefly mentioned, on the evenings between about the 14th and 17th of February, Venus and Jupiter, the two brightest planets, can be seen together just after sunset. They're closest, in fact, on the 16th of February, but then they're only about 4 degrees above the horizon, and there's a lovely crescent moon hanging in the sky above. That should be a lovely sight. You need to get somewhere where you have a very good low, basically southwestern horizon, so you can see low towards the horizon. Those 2 days, well worth having a look out for Jupiter and Venus. Well, Mars, as I've said, it's still a very good month to observe it. Opposition was on Jan the 29th, and so now it's becoming higher in the sky in the evening. It's not as big as it sometimes is. Because Mars has an elliptical orbit, when we are at closest approach, sometimes Mars is a good bit nearer than it is now. The angular size has been about 14 arc seconds, but on a really good apparition, and there was one a few years ago when Mars was at its closest for 60,000 years, it's up to about 25 arc seconds. Gradually over the next 10 years, it'll start getting a bit bigger again when it's closest. But you can at least see it, and a good thing this time is it's actually nice and high in the sky. It gets up to about 60 degrees, so even though the image is small, you haven't got quite so much of the atmosphere to degrade it if you look at it with a small telescope. The North Pole is pointing towards us. You should see the North Polar Cap quite easily. Now, occasionally, we can see some of the brighter asteroids. The second largest asteroid, or second most massive, is Vesta, diameter of 530 kilometres. It's actually, though, the brightest and has a magnitude of plus 6.1, which means you could just see it with your unaided eye under perfect conditions. Now, during the month, it actually passes very close to the bright star Algieba, which is up in Leo the Lion. It's the star at the base of the main, really. And on the 16th of the month, it actually passes between Algieba and the star 40 Leonis, and it should therefore be very easy to pick out. I have put a little plot on the night sky page of the Jodrell Bank website. Just put night sky into Google, it'll come up, which shows you the path of Vesta through Leo around that time. And then finally, on February the 21st, the moon occults some of the stars of the Pleiades cluster. One of the pretty things about the Pleiades cluster, there's a beautiful arc of stars that sort of curves round to the lower left. And the moon, at about first quarter, is going to actually occult those stars, which means that the leading edge of the limb is dark. So those stars will just suddenly appear to disappear, if you can say that. That's about 1850 on the evening of February the 21st. That might be quite a nice little thing to look out for. Again, the diagram I've put on the web, in fact, shows the Pleiades with the lovely nebulosity. You won't see that, of course, because of the light from the moon. But I couldn't get a picture easily which didn't actually show that, but at the same time showed me the bright stars, or the stars that the moon's going to occult. Okay, well now, we've been particularly asked by someone who's going to be in Sydney this month if we can talk about the southern sky. He asked if there was anything special he could see, such as a meteor shower. Sadly not. But let me just say some of the things that can be seen down in the southern sky. There's a region, basically Sagittarius through to Canis Major, that sadly we don't really see very well from our northern climes. Let me just point out one or two of the things along the Milky Way in that region. Well, Sagittarius, the main stars make up a teapot. And just above the teapot, there's a lovely region of luminosity called the Lagoon Nebula. You can easily see that with binoculars, maybe even with your eye. If you imagine tea coming out of the spout, they actually cross the position of a very nice open cluster. There are actually two open clusters, although, to be honest, they are just within the borders of the next constellation, which is Scorpius. Scorpius has that bright star Antares, a reddish star. But as the tail curves round, there's a bit of a kink, and there you see something that looks a little bit like a comet. There's a lovely cluster, something's called the Northern Jewel Box, but some nebulosity, and it's a bit of an arc, and it does look a little bit like a comet, so that's nice to see in binoculars too. We then come to a very large constellation, Centaurus. It has two very bright stars, Alpha Centauri and Beta Centauri. They are pointers because they actually point to the Southern Cross, which is surrounded by Centaurus. Now, Alpha Centauri is in fact two bright stars, one slightly bigger than the Sun, one slightly smaller, orbiting each other. And they lie at about 4.2 light years away. So the reason they appear bright is because they're close. We believe there's a third member of that little group, which is Alpha Centauri C, and that in fact is normally called Proxima Centauri, because at 4.21 light years distance, it's in fact the nearest star to us. It's a little faint red dwarf star at about 11th magnitude. Now, Beta Centauri doesn't look nearly as bright, but in fact, it's about 100 times further away than Alpha Centauri, which means it must fundamentally be a very bright star, and it's one of the brightest stars we can actually see with our unaided eye. If you turn sort of up to the left from Beta Centauri, so you sort of curve round a bit, and go about one bright star and the same distance again, you may see a little fuzzy object with binoculars. It's actually about the size of the full moon, and that's Omega Centauri, which is thought, has been thought to be a globular cluster and the largest and brightest we have in our skies, but may well in fact be just the core of a galaxy which has been disrupted by its passage around our own Milky Way. It has got some young stars in it which globular clusters don't, and it's suspected it has a black hole at its heart. Well, the pointers point towards Crux, a little constellation surrounded by Centaurus, a little cross of stars. Just below the left-hand cross, star of the cross, is a beautiful little thing called the Jewel Box. It's a lovely cluster. Most of the stars are blue, but there's in fact one red giant in there, which gives a lovely colour contrast. And below that, there's a region that looks quite dark. It's called the Coalsack, one of the darkest dark nebulae we see along the Milky Way, a region of dust which is obscuring the light from beyond. Well, beyond Crux, we have what used to be the constellation Argo Navis. That's been split, and the upper part is Vela, the sails, and the lower part is Carina, the keel. And again, there are some nice objects in there. The bright star in Carina is called Canopus, and that's often been used for navigation. I've mentioned before the Eta Carina Nebula, or the Carina Nebula, where there's a star that's likely to explode. That's a very nice bright region. And also not far from there is a little cluster called the Southern Pleiades. It looks like a sort of a slightly smaller version of the Pleiades we see in the northern sky. So it's a lovely region of the sky, and I do sometimes envy those who live in the Southern Hemisphere who have a chance to see it more often than I do. I do travel down south every couple of years or so, and will be there in the summer, so I'm hoping to look forward to seeing these things again. Thank you.
Thanks for that, Ian. And now we're going to move on to your feedback, and we're starting off with an erratum that was emailed in by Stuart Ayres. And he says, "Hi there, don't know if you do anything with errors by the interviewee, but I realised I said that another example of Sakurai's object was Nova Aquilae 1909. It is in fact Nova Aquilae 1919, which is V605 Aquilae. How's that for professional pride? We do like it when our interviewees get back to us."
Well, it's good to know that they've actually listened to the interview.
Yes, exactly. Some more people who've been listening to our interviews have been posting over on the forum.
So on the forum, we've got Earth Unit, who loves the in-depth answers from Tim. And he says, "I mean, where else could I find out that if I was to get thrown off a spaceship, my skin would keep all my gooey inner bits together?" So thanks for that, Earth yes. Unit. And Rapid Eye agrees with Earth Unit, saying it was a very chilling piece.
Oh,
it's awful, isn't it?
That's worse than one of my segues.
Also on the forum, Jody the Oak is very disappointed in Neil and says that he might have to go and join Slacker Astronomy as he has not been keeping up to date with the Jodcast. And also a new user on the forum is OG, who says that he caught Megan's 365 Days of Astronomy show. Nicely done. And he has one scheduled for the 15th of the 2nd.
Fantastic. Well, we will be listening out for that one. Megan also, just as a by the way, has got a Doctor Who story out about surfing supernovae.
I think maybe more important is that Megan has been published in Nature, which
is
a very big deal.
Fantastic, fantastic achievement. So well done, Megan. And we look forward to many more. So now on to your Facebook feedback, and Atul Nayak says, "I'm a first-timer and I started with the January Jodcast." He's listening from Goa on the west coast of India, and he says, "Thanks for a great episode, very lively, informative, and not a boring second." He's also told us about his experience of the annular solar eclipse back in the middle of January, which was witnessed by millions in India and elsewhere. It was a little bit miffed that this wasn't mentioned on the Jodcast, so we apologise for that, and we will try and make sure that all eclipses and other interesting phenomena in the sky will be mentioned wherever in the world.
And if you're listening elsewhere in the world, it would be great for you to get in touch with us. We always like to know how far away our listeners are.
And that includes if you're on the International Space Station downloading us. Send us a tweet.
Over on Twitter, thanks to Astronomy2009 for tweeting about the January 2010 show. And that was one where we were discussing the International Year of Astronomy. So that's been retweeted by a few people. Thanks for that. And we're apparently the DLF podcast of the week. Thanks to DLF Resources for tweeting about that.
That's the Digital Learning Foundation. Wow. And they also retweeted that I was in Measure for Measure this last week. In our email feedback, Joe Stainton said, "I just wanted to say that I was introduced to the Jodcast about 12 months ago while studying for my amateur radio licence at Huddersfield Technical College. Astronomy, radio astronomy and science in general are of particular interest to radio amateurs the world over. Your show is a fascinating resource. Please keep it up." Jim Omans, we kept him from going completely crazy on a packed flight from Guam to Honolulu to Houston to Washington.
Wow.
So, yes, he's got another very long trip coming up, and he's hoping that he can download another Jodcast before he goes. So we'll hopefully get this one out for you, Jim. And Robert Siddy says that he's an immigration lawyer who loves astronomy and your site, and thank you all very much. And with that, we come to our thanks, because unfortunately this is the end of this edition. So our thanks go to Dr. Miguel Santander García and Dr. Pablo Rodriguez for the interviews. The interviews were edited together by Jen and Adam Averson, with an honourable mention to Dave Jones for his editing skills. And the show was put together by Sarah Bryan, Adam Averson, Chris Tibbs, Ian MacDonald, and Stuart Lowe.
It's a very collaborative effort. We're trying to take over from Stuart, so this was a very much a learning experience with this one.
Let's not say we're trying to take over from Stuart.
We're trying to lighten the load.
Yes, we are. My thanks must go to Christopher Stadther, Cheryl Cunningham and Lynn Cullen for their parts in our Groundhog Day intro-outro, which was put together by Fiona Thrale. From the two of us sitting here in the Jodcast recording studio here at the Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics, Jod on.
Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
so there you have it, straight from the Jodcast mouth. Get your MP3 players primed, because it's going to be a long life for this astronomy podcast, at least in Mangsatani Chester. Reporting for Channel 9 News, this is Phil Platers.
That was really good, Phil. How did you...
Because I've heard it again and again. And when will they change the music? Self-referential intros, I ask you.